Hello and welcome to The Reading Life, WWNO's weekly look at the New Orleans literary scene. I'm Susan Larson. The Tennessee Williams New Orleans Literary Festival is right around the corner, so today we'll be meeting some of the featured guests. Thomas Keith, who edits Williams' work for New Directions, will speak about his lifelong reading of Williams' plays and memoirs. And former Louisiana State Poet Laureate Brenda Marie Osby will give us a look behind the making of her new collection, History and Other Poems. Chances are, if you've been to the Tennessee Williams Festival over the past 27 years, you've heard something wonderful or enlightening from Thomas Keith. Thomas edits the Williams titles for New Directions, and over the years, he's been responsible for some remarkable guests appearing at the festival. Thomas is an adjunct professor of theater at Pace University, and he's taught acting at the Lee Strasberg Institute. Today, we'll be talking about his long reading of Tennessee Williams' works. Hi, Thomas.
Good morning, Susan.
Now, do you remember your first encounter with Tennessee Williams' works?
I do remember my first encounter with Tennessee Williams. I was a sophomore in high school, and we were planning the Winter One-Act Festival, and people were madly reading one-act plays. And I read this strange little play called The Case of the Crushed Petunia, which I thought we should do. And nobody else did, so we didn't do it.
Oh, no.
And then the following year in English class, we read The Glass Menagerie. And so that was my real introduction.
And when did you realize that his work would be a focus in your professional life?
It evolved over time. It was not something that I set out to do, really. I worked for New Directions, actually as a typist in the late 80s, early 90s, when I was finding my way as an actor in New York. And they learned pretty quickly that I was a big Tennessee Williams fan and that I knew a fair amount about him. And they started giving me freelance jobs. And one of the first ones was back in 89 to take all of the previously unpublished or unproduced Tennessee Williams material in the office and write a report about it. So that was the first time I looked at a lot of the later work, some of the earlier plays that hadn't been published yet. And then over the years, I freelanced for New Directions on and off, doing copy editing and proofing and typing and so forth with Williams plays until I was a full-time employee there for 8 years. And since 2009, I've been a consulting editor, and I keep getting to work with Tennessee Williams.
Oh, that's great. Now, it's really interesting to me that this year you'll be talking with three Williams biographers about their books and Williams' work. How does biography inform your work as an editor?
Well, first of all, some people are surprised, why does Tennessee Williams need an editor? Part of the reason is the massive amount of material that there is. Up until 2008, a lot of it was still unpublished. There's very little that's unpublished now, but there was as much published after he died as before he died. So there was a certain amount of upkeep and care that way. And the other reason is that some of the plays are starting to be five, six, seven decades old now, and it made common sense to reissue them, relaunch them with introductions. And so knowing about Williams' biography is important in choosing the people who make those introductions.
And you made some divine matches in those introductions, I must say. Tell us about some of those.
Well, one of them, for example, was the memoirs. The memoirs had originally been published by Doubleday in 1975, and they were a bestseller, but they were also a scandal. And today, what seemed very over-the-top or outrageous back then seems rather modest today in the way he talked about his sexuality and sexual liaisons. But at the time, people were very upset about it, and he got a lot of grief for it, and there were a lot of pieces written in the New York Times and elsewhere complaining that he was too out there as a gay man. And so when it came to reissue the memoirs, people were suggesting Hollywood stars, directors, theater people, various people to make an introduction for the reissue. And what I was thinking is, who's somebody who never had to come out, whose identity as a gay person is not at issue, who can address the memoirs themselves? And as a matter of fact, there was something in a New Orleans magazine where John Waters was interviewed, and he was naming influences. And I remember Genet was one, and Williams was one. And so I wrote to him based on that, and he loved the idea and, as you know, wrote a beautiful introduction to the memoir.
And then came to the festival to talk about it. Thank you very much.
Twice.
I know. I adore him. We've been so lucky to have him.
Yeah, one of my favorite memories is Zoe Caldwell and John Waters being introduced to one another before a panel in 2011, hitting it off.
Many people hit it off at the festival, don't you think? Oh, now you'll be speaking on a panel called They Told Me to Take a Streetcar Named Desire, a Classic Revisited. Don't you think somehow the rereading and revisiting is maybe something that happens more commonly in theater than fiction? There's that whole idea of committing the work to memory.
Yes, I think that's true. And I think part of it is because we get to see the play from time to time. We either get to see the play on stage or we get to see the film adaptation. And Williams is unique in so many respects. And one of them is that his plays are just that. They're plays. They work as live events. The text is blueprint for a much larger experience that happens between the actors and the audience in a theater. And at the same time, they're so beautiful on the page. They're so quotable. And I think that over time, the plays and the dialogue of certain writers just seep into our consciousness. And Tennessee Williams is one of them. There's so many quotable lines in Streetcar.
All right. What's your favorite? I had to ask.
Well, just off the top of my head, do I paraphrase or do I go look it up?
Whatever you like. You can paraphrase.
Let me see if I can remember it. Don't you just love these long, rainy afternoons in the quarter when an hour isn't just an hour, but a little piece of eternity dropped into your hand, and who knows what to do with it? That's a line of Blanche.
I love that. That's my favorite. What excellent taste we have. Now, so how often do you reread Williams?
Over the years now, because of the work that I do for New Directions and because of my participation in the Tennessee Williams Provincetown Theater Festival and the New Orleans Literary Festival, quite a bit. I find myself rereading them, and every time I read a Williams play, I find something new. I discover something that I didn't understand the last time. They're quite rich and quite layered. And I'm also now, I have the opportunity at Pace to teach them. I've got a script analysis class right now. We just spent 3 weeks on Streetcar.
Wow. Would you say he's your favorite writer? Does he have that place in your heart?
Yes. I would say the short answer is yes. By leaps and bounds, the writer whose work I spend the most time with.
Ah, well, good. Now, in recent years, you've curated with Paul Willis this wonderful event with festival speakers, a Saturday night reading, and this year, it's Tennessee Williams in Others' Words. Tell us about some of the choices you've made for that.
Well, I'm in the midst of making those choices right now. Some of them will be as early as we can get in terms of written observations about Williams, and that's a little trickier. We have one from University of Missouri at Columbia newspaper feature article about Williams from 1930 that describes him as a person who doesn't like having questions asked about himself. We have his mother and his brother's account. And then there'll be some reviews, and actually I'm looking for the sort of more surprising reviews where people didn't like what are now considered classic plays, where people give a bad review of Streetcar or Menagerie, and there certainly were plenty of them.
That'll be fun to hear.
I think so. And then some actors' point of views. There's a great book from the 60s called A Look at Tennessee Williams, Conversations With, and there were a lot of famous actors of the day who told stories about working with Williams. And then there's a section, since we have so many playwrights as readers, that Marcia Norman, Emily Mann, John Patrick Shanley, and I'm going to add Don Murray to that, are going to read from fellow playwrights talking about Williams' work. So, for example, Don Murray will read Arthur Miller, and John Patrick Shanley will read his own introduction from The Rose Tattoo.
Well, that should be wickedly good, I must say.
I think so. I think it's been good to hear Williams' own words, and it's good for people to know about those more obscure, less famous works. But this will be unique in that we'll hear other people talk about Williams.
Oh, it's going to be so much fun. All right, Thomas, it's always a delight to speak with you. I look forward to seeing you at the festival, and thanks for all you do. For details about Thomas Keith's appearance, check out TennesseeWilliams.net. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Susan.
Brenda Marie Osby is one of Louisiana's most revered and honored poets. In 2005, she was the first peer-selected poet laureate of the state of Louisiana. She is currently a distinguished visiting professor of Africana at Brown University, so we lose her to Rhode Island every fall, but then she returns to New Orleans every spring. A New Orleans native, she received the 1998 American Book Award for her collection, All Saints, New and Selected Poems. Her new book, which we'll be talking about today, is called History and Other Poems. Brenda Marie, welcome.
Hello.
So much of your work is rooted in history, and History and Other Poems is a stark and unrelenting look at the Atlantic slave trade. What was it like for you to dwell so long in such a dark and evil time?
Well, one of the things that poetry does exceptionally well is it allows us to tell stories that we already know, or that we think we already know or claim to know, in greater depth and detail, and perhaps more unreservedly than any other medium. The book, as you can tell, is research-based and was many years in the making. And so it wasn't a single concentrated period of focus. Rather, it was more like bits and chunks of time until eventually I landed in Cassis at the Camargo Foundation in Cassis, just outside Marseille, where I had a residency of 6 months, where I was able to concentrate full time on a manuscript that was growing around a poem that had not yet been written. Ah. So there were these other poems that were functioning as kinds of constellations, and the root poem, History itself, had not yet been written. And so it was between January and July of 2004 that I had that first concentrated period when I could sit and look at that work and also do much of the background research without any distractions. And so it was a hard undertaking.
But it's rich in historical detail, and real figures stride across these pages. Who are some of these people who compelled you so in the writing of this?
It isn't so much the historical figures who matter in these poems, although there are several. There's Pope Nicholas V. There is Christopher Columbus, of course. There's the explorer Diogo Cao. But they are adjuncts to the kinds of narratives that are being told in these poems. In the Columbus poem, for instance, regarding the intermediate travels of Cristóbal Colón, the primary voices are those of the King of the Caribs and his warrior princess daughter. For the most part, these poems take on the voices of historical figures whom we do not know. And part of the premise of the entire volume is that these are the voices that truly matter.
Right. And your work is so beautiful. I always think of your poetry as singing history to life and making something beautiful out of really inhumane kinds of situations. Do you have that sense of making something beautiful out of this as you write?
I have a strong sense of language as its own kind of beauty. And one of the things that I try to focus on, for instance, when I teach poetry, is the kind of wordplay that any poet in any language tends to joy in, no matter what the topic might be. Language, in and of itself, has a kind of hypnotic power. We go into these narratives knowing that we're going to be told horrible things,
right,
but we can't stop ourselves because we're drawn along not only by the story, but by the heft and sway and pull of language.
And it's not only the English language for you, it's many, many languages.
I keep a huge language notebook. And in that notebook, I keep word lists, I keep etymologies, I keep exercises in language. It's kind of an old-fashioned workbook, you might say.
Oh, that's wonderful. I mean, you list all these African languages in these poems. That sense of that, was that from research that you've done over the years?
Yes. The title poem history, I wanted to be careful to include not so much the voices of the Atlantic slave trade, but the languages of the Atlantic slave trade. And I wanted us to have a sense of the far-reaching nature of that trade. And so I included references to as many languages as I could connect to. I wanted to be very careful to include some of the lesser known languages so that we have a sense of how broad and far reaching the transatlantic slave trade really was and is.
I thought that was wonderful. And you also include that helpful glossary at the back, so people will love these words. Whenever I read poetry, I kind of carry the book around my house and I read it out loud because I don't think you fully appreciate it on the page.
You're 100% right. For me, as a poet, any line, any word, any passage has to work aloud as well as on the page, or somehow, in my mind, it doesn't quite function as poetry. We have to be able to hear language sing and cry and speak and rant. We have to be able to hear those qualities. And I think that that's why the poetry reading as an event has the kind of impact in our society as it does.
It can be life-changing.
I should say also that the glossary is sort of the gift of my late mother. When my very first book was published, one of the problems I had was that people were always asking me about New Orleans expressions and place names. And beginning with the second book, my mother was my go-to source for the glossaries for all of the successive books. And so History and Other Poems was the last book that my mother assisted me with. She's been dead now 2.5 years.
Oh.
And so I see the glossaries as a gift that she gave to me.
Mm-hmm. That's lovely. Well, since we've talked about reading aloud, I wonder if you'd read one of the poems for us.
I'll read Qu'on arrive enfin, A Tale in Progress. One. And so we arrive at last in our native land, the earth itself marked by slavery. Up there in the open air, the stink, the hot funk of hot blood, the rowdy rebel niggers of the past. Funny, no, how we always return to this, the city, the life that slavery built, tales altogether invented as told by historians, founding fathers, the church. But we are sick and tired of lies, dirty tricks, and fraud. We are sick of tales and of historians, sick of indigo, tobacco, rice, and rum. We are sick of king cotton and sugar cane, sick of it all, and can only wish hard, hard, hard that the lakes, the bayous, swamps, large and small, will have swallowed it all, flooded, erased it all. But then we don't bother about this, really, because there's always the chance of hurricane. Therefore, down with the dealers in blood and in flesh. Long live the conquering hurricane. Long live the leveling swamp. Long live the rowdy rebel niggers and the bad little niggers as well. Let there remain not one single plantation to reek of the stench of roasted flesh and blood. 2. And so I ask myself, what would suffice? And my answer, nothing. Not a single thing. As long as ever I live, nothing, nothing, nothing shall ever suffice it. 3. Used to be, a good while back, used to be they'd chop heads over far less. And how many bloody heads would have rolled back then? And so every time we hear the word Creole, or better still, Le Monde Créole, the fetid breath of the slavers and their lesser merchantmen, and the great stench of their women taking their little whores' baths only every 3 days or so. And so what? What's it to us, we ask ourselves from time to time, 1,000 times over, what's it to us? Used to be, once upon a time. 4. And I cannot, quite fathom it all. 5. What then is history? Hardly even fable, hardly even myth. Nothing but the lies repeated by masters and their henchmen, nothing but lines repeated ad nauseam in order to memorize them well enough, in order to entertain themselves well enough, until time for slashing the throat of one of their negresses only after having fed her good and raw. Oh, it's the factories, the accounting houses, over there, just along the river, where they produce neither grain nor sugar nor anything else. The social science of slavery. Répétez, s'il vous plaît. Répétez, s'il vous plaît. Tous à la fois, à la fois, à la fois.
I love that. Thank you so much. Now, let's talk as well about this wonderful essay you have, Encircling Faith, Southern Women on Spirituality. And your essay is called, Why We Can't Talk to You About Voodoo.
Yes. One of the things that every native New Orleanian suffers is the condition of having everyone in the world be an expert on us and our culture. We're always being corrected in the pronunciation of our street names, our family names, any and everything we say. And so I thought that since so much nonsense has been written, published, filmed, and believed about this one particular topic, voodoo, I thought that it would be really nice to turn the tables and to give to the casual, quote-unquote, reader of New Orleans culture a taste of their own medicine. And so I had a great deal of fun writing this essay, and it's part of a series of pieces on this topic. The other two are more serious. I try to give information about the place of the religion in New Orleans culture, but I'm very serious when I say that we really can't talk about this topic. And that's part of the problem, is that because it's a religion that requires that we not breach certain boundaries outside the faith itself, part of what happens is that it leaves us open to all kinds of invention. And so there is not a book anywhere in the world that you can pick up that says anything even remotely intelligent about our religion. Mm-hmm. But then you shouldn't be looking for it in books anyways.
Right.
that's part of the point of the essay. There is a longer, more serious and more stately, I hope, essay called By Affliction. Mm-hmm. And it's about the roles of the mothers in the faith. What everyone else calls a priestess, that concept simply doesn't exist in our religion, and we call those women mothers. So as soon as someone says voodoo priestess, you know that they're a fake, a fraud, or that they've just been reading crazy magazine articles somewhere.
Well, I love this essay because it was so much fun to see you have so much fun. There was this tone of, let me tell you, just let me set this straight for you.
Yeah, I was really angry when I wrote it. And there had been a number of local publications about voodoo that were very touristy. Mm-hmm. And in fact, I was contacted to contribute. And I just refused outright and said, absolutely not. I mean, there are just certain things that you see over and over. Terms used out of context, just all kinds of very bizarre Frenchifications of words that are African in origin and so forth, and these elaborate folk definitions and backgrounds that are created, sometimes out of a very real absence of information, but also sometimes, I think, to erase, to disappear the blackness, the Africaneity of New Orleans as a space, as a place historically.
Mm-hmm. Which is so important to our city's identity.
Exactly.
The very bedrock.
Exactly.
Oh, well, you can meet Brenda Marie Osby and hear her speak at the Tennessee Williams New Orleans Literary Festival in March. That's Saturday, March 23rd at 4 p.m. at the Historic New Orleans Collections Williams Research Center. For more information, check out TennesseeWilliams.net. Thank you so much, Brenda Marie.
Thank you for having me.
Here's what's on tap in the literary life this week. Gail Thompson will discuss Diane Ogaki's book, The Dream of the Turquoise Bee, Tuesday, March 12th from 6:30 to 8 p.m. at Maple Street Bookshop in the New Orleans Healing Center. leading up to the Healing Center's Sacred Music Fest. Aimé Agresti signs her young adult novel, Infatuate, Tuesday, March 12th at 5 at Octavia Books. Paul Durrell signs Living the Artist's Life, Tuesday, March 12th at 6 p.m. at Garden District Bookshop. Roger Kamenetz signs The Jew and the Lotus, Thursday, March 14th from 6:30 to 8:30 p.m. at Maple Street Bookshop in the New Orleans Healing Center. Tulane University history professor Terrence Fitzmaurice discusses an extremely precarious and uncertain character of property, Irish slave owners and slavery in antebellum New Orleans, Thursday, March 14th at 7 p.m. at East Bank Regional Library in Metairie. Poets Hilary Gravendick and Peter Orr read Thursday, March 14th at 8 p.m. at the Goldmine Saloon as part of the 17 Poets Literary and Performance Series. Christy Atwood presents a motivational interactive presentation, Top Time Tips for Writers, because there really are enough hours in the day. That's Saturday, March 16th at 10 a.m. at the meeting of the Southern Louisiana Chapter of Romance Writers of America. That's at the East Bank Regional Library in Metairie. All are welcome. Earl Hampton Jr. signs The Streetcar Guide to New Orleans, written with Louis Costa, Andre Neff, and Peter Rarup, Saturday, March 16th from 1 to 3 at Maple Street Bookshop on Maple Street. Tom Andes reads his story, The Hit, from the Best American Mystery Stories 2012, Saturday, March 16th at 6 at Maple Street Bookshop on Bayou St. John. Kid Chef Ileana signs Cool Kids Cook, Saturday, March 16th at 1:30 at Octavia Books. Robert Ferris signs Flood of Conflict, the New Orleans Free School Story, Wednesday, March 20th at 6 p.m. at Octavia Books. Michael Hurst signs Unusual Creatures, a mostly accurate account of some of the Earth's strangest animals. That's his book and his CD, Songs for Unusual Creatures, Thursday, March 21st at 6 at Octavia Books. Sarah Carr signs Hope Against Hope, Three Schools, One City, and the Struggle to Educate America's Children, Thursday, March 21st at 6:30 at Maple Street Bookshop in the New Orleans Healing Center. Here are some events to look for at the Tennessee Williams New Orleans Literary Festival, coming up March 20th through 24th at the Hotel Monteleone. Today's guest, Thomas Keith, moderates a panel with Tennessee Williams biographers John S. Back, David Kaplan, and William J. Smith at 11:30 Saturday at the Williams Research Center. Saturday, he appears on a panel, They Told Me to Take a Streetcar Named Desire, revisiting a classic, with actress-director Aimé Hayes, playwright-director Emily Young, and theater professor Harvey Young, with moderator David Kaplan. That's 2:30 Saturday at the Williams Research Center. Keith also curates Tennessee Williams In Others' Words, readings by festival luminaries Saturday night at the Queen Anne Ballroom at the Hotel Monteleone. And today's guest, poet Brenda Marie Osby, appears Saturday, March 23rd at 4 p.m. at the Williams Research Center, reading from her work, along with Ava Lavelle Heyman, Neo Sundari, Brad Richard, and Carolyn Hembry. For more information and tickets, check out TennesseeWilliams.net. Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Christwood Retirement Community, Our Lady of Holy Cross College, and the University of Louisiana at Lafayette Press. The Reading Life is produced by Jenny Lawson and is a production of WWNO. You can listen to us anytime or subscribe to our podcast at wwno.org. Or you can email us anytime at thereadinglife@wwno.org. I'm Susan Larson. Thanks for listening and keep reading.